Welcome back, everyone. If it's easy for you to turn your video back on, it's nice to see people as I'm speaking, if that can work for you. Recognizing that some might have bandwidth issues. So this week and last week, I've watched some the hearings of the Congressional Committee, this is in the United States, investigating the January 6th insurrection. How many people have either heard or watched some of that? Right. And so it's quite striking and also illustrative. Generally, the people developing it are mostly from one party, the Democratic Party, and the Republican leadership doesn't want to participate in the committee. The two Republicans who are on the committee have been excommunicated. So I'm not going to talk particularly about those events, but I wanted to take that as the sign of polarization in the society and explore today how we work with polarization, difference, conflict, whether it's an internal conflict or whether it's an interpersonal conflict or whether it's on a larger level, such as a society. And I know that this is occurring, that aspects of polarization are also occurring in many other countries. You know, I know we have regularly people from France and Germany, and I know that that kind of polarization is also happening to a significant extent in those countries. And so there's polarization about the last election in the United States. And there's polarization on most of the most important issues, like working with, to respond to the climate crisis, to deal with gun violence and voter suppression and racism and so forth. There's tremendous polarization. And when issues get polarized like that, often there's paralysis in dealing with the issues. You know, what we find, I think, very typically with polarization, there's a lack of empathy or understanding of those on, quote unquote, the other side. There can be a kind of breakdown of friendship, of communication, of collegiality. You know, when there's that kind of polarization, it can be very depressing and distressing for some people. People withdraw emotionally and so forth. And it's a major concern in this country, and I think in many parts of the world. There's, how many people could identify with one or more of those issues I mentioned, you know, to connect with that. And there, you know, and yeah, I know in the United States, there's actually among many people a fear of something like a civil war, fear of violence, you know, fear of people on the other side. And so, you know, and there are many factors which are, you know, behind that kind of polarization, maybe including, I think the internet plays a role. People are increasingly in what are sometimes called information silos and so forth. But what I wanted to do especially is to ask the question, how do we understand polarization, and how can we use our resources from our practice to work with differences, with conflicts, with polarization again, whether it occurs even internally, an inner conflict that I have, or interpersonally in a community or on a larger scale in a society. I think what I have found over the years is that the principles for working with something individually or interpersonally are actually the same as responding to a concern at the level of a community or the whole society. And I hope we can see that more clearly. So that's what I want to focus on. And what I want to do in the course of the session here is identify five basic ways of practicing when there are differences or conflicts. And I want to encourage us to bring this to the next week. If you have differences with someone, including someone close to you, or in your community, or if you look at the larger scale, bring these practices into the situation. And that'll be the heart of the talk. We'll be identifying five practices that we can bring to situations of difference and conflict. And then I'll invite us to work with that during the week and come back next week, see how we've done. Because I think that this kind of work is actually on a deep level. If this was brought into the whole country, this would bring about healing and transformation. We have a long way to go, but I think that it's very clear that something like this is what is needed. So, a little more background. What I find is that these issues of polarization and I would say not being able to work with differences and conflicts are very, very widespread. And I think we find them in many different settings, not just at a national level. So I find these also in many, among many people interested in social change and social justice. I can find those kind of tendencies. I once went to a conference on spiritual activism. I was invited. This was a conference which had about 2,000 people, and I was invited to lead a session. And my session was on what kind of trainings are important for people who are interested in spiritual activism or spiritually grounded, action in the world. And before I gave my own sense of what a curriculum might be, I asked people, let me know what kind of issues are important for you. And what, this was actually about 15 years ago, and what they said, our organizations have so much conflict, and people are sometimes very mean to each other, and we sometimes put so much of our energy into just kind of fighting with each other that we have less energy for the outer world. Does anyone relate to that from your own experience? Can see that, yeah. And so that's what I found. That's what people told me. I wasn't prompting them. That's just what they told me. And, there can be, of course, people can be really helping with important issues, but the negative side is there can also be self-righteousness, dogmatism, attacking people who are just a little bit different than one, maybe in one's organization, lack of empathy towards opponents, often not trying to understand them accurately, sort of demonization. Those of you who live in the Bay Area, there is a wonderful radio station in the Pacifica network called KPFA that I listen to quite a bit. It's sort of from a social perspective, it's what we would call progressive, but I'm informed by it and learn a lot. But I also notice that probably the vast majority of commentary, people basically badmouth. Sorry for the slang for those with other languages. Badmouth means speak negatively. Okay. But people speak negatively about the other side, and I don't think that there's really often a fair account that the other person would agree with of what is being criticized, right? It's often like what we would call a straw man or a caricature, And I notice that over and over again. There are very few times when there actually are friendly, sincere debates between people on different sides. That doesn't happen much, right? It's mostly just attack. I see that in the social change organizations and, in these kind of dialogues. And I read an article in the last few days which said that actually, since the pandemic, this has gotten much worse. And large numbers of social change organizations, included among these are the Sierra Club, which does environmental work, and the American Civil Liberties Union, which works with free speech issues and among others. Large numbers of organizations have been consumed by internal infighting that has really distracted them from actually doing their work in the larger world. And that it's very, this article just documented this over and over again. That there was just internal conflict. Some of it, a lot of it was around, between staff and leadership, sometimes around issues of diversity, related to race or gender, but a lot of conflicts that are somehow not being handled, not being handled well. And what I have seen also in my own experience is that when organizations don't go skillfully into charged issues, it's often, to use a Buddhist technical term, a mess. Very, it gets very, very, very messy. I've seen that personally. In one training program, which I guided, we had 5 7-day retreats. And at the second retreat, we wanted to go into different kinds of diversity issues related to ethnicity, race, gender, and so forth, sexual orientation. And I brought in some facilitators, but we didn't really have well-developed guidelines for working with differences. And at that retreat, the messiness was very, very rough. It nearly tore the program apart, right? We didn't handle it well. And so we decided for the next 7-day retreat, we spent 7 days on how to work skillfully with conflict. And then we went back into the issues. And I think that's what it took, because I've also found that these kind of differences, or not differences, difficulties with differences and conflicts, I've also seen over and over again in spiritual communities as well. It can be a little bit depressing, right, to notice this. I've seen it happen at Spirit Rock multiple times. I've seen it happen at other centers. There was in the Thai forest tradition at some of the Western monasteries, they found they were very unskillful with conflicts, and they brought in training in wise speech. And they particularly brought in training in nonviolent communication to help them. That's occurred because they found that they didn't have the resources to deal with differences and conflicts. And again, I've seen it from close up, sometimes at Spirit Rock. I've seen it at other centers. And I think it's, from my perspective, it's sometimes connected with having our emphasis on our spiritual training be exclusively on inner practice and not bringing it out so much often into our relationships, into working with differences and conflicts and communities. I think that's a general issue which I would point to, which is part of the background. But it's also, it's also very sobering to see one's own communities not very skillful sometimes when there are differences or conflicts. How many people know something like that from your own experience? Even at home, or it could be, it could be in your family or your extended family or in your community. And I, again, I've seen that, personally. And just sometimes people actually don't want to try to resolve conflicts, you know, that they maybe don't, it's not part of their background. And there are reasons for all of this, you know. What I have found from my own, looking at my own background and talking with people, is that generally speaking, I think it's certainly true in the U.S., but I imagine it's true in many other cultures, there's lack of much background or training to be skillful with differences or conflicts. In fact, I would say the predominant tendency is towards one of two kinds of conditioning. You know, many people who are attracted to meditation share the first kind of conditioning, which is to be conflict avoidant. You know, it's to not have had good examples, maybe in one's family, of skillful work with conflict, of caring and empathy, and the possibility in which we can, you know, the positive vision here is that conflict dealt with well deepens relationships, deepens community, and permits learning. That's the vision, right? And whether that's internal conflict or interpersonal conflict, and I've seen that over and over again in my own experience, interpersonally, when we really can air conflicts and be skillful with them, the relationship deepens. How many of you know something like that in your own experience, right? That when you work skillfully with something difficult, the relationship deepens. What happens when you don't deal with it skillfully, whether you just ignore it or don't deal with it unskillfully? The relationship either stays static or it gets worse, right? I think that's true at the level of interpersonal relationships. It's true at the level of communities. It's true at the level of a society, right? And again, what I'll be getting to are five practices that help us be skillful. But we have to know that there are tendencies either to be conflict avoidant, which generally when I teach in meditative circles, the vast majority of people in meditative circles had conflict avoidant upbringing. How many people can relate to that? Yeah. The other possibility is what we could call conflict indulgence, where you just jump into conflict, but it's also unconscious. People just jump into it. How many people had something like that as your conditioning or your background, right? So to some extent, it's tied with ethnic background. You know, it's interesting in terms of people of European background, those from more the north and the west tend to be conflict avoidant. Those more from like Southern Europe or Eastern Europe, like Italians or sometimes Eastern Europe, tends to be more conflict indulgent. So I lived once in Boston in what's called Little Italy. A lot of immigrants recently from Italy, and during the summer when it was hot, they had their windows open and you could hear arguments within apartments, you know, like half a block away. They were out there, right? And it's not necessarily a more skillful way of working conflict. But then, you know, and so my family background is Eastern European. They tended to be more conflict indulgent, just kind of getting into it. And some members of my family, extended family, are like that. But I got brought up more kind of, you know, getting assimilated into kind of the, you know, whatever we call it, the mainstream. And it was more conflict avoidant, you know. So for me, conflict was scary, right? And it's also true in other parts of the world. I know I've spent time in Thailand. And Thailand also, at least publicly, people are very conflict avoidant. You know, I remember helping to co-organize an event among Buddhist practitioners in Thailand, which was about 3 or 4 days. And at the end of it, we kind of brought in aspects of California. We brought in a chance for people to say things they liked and things they didn't like about the 4 days, sort of, you know, community feedback at the end. And this was not Thai style, right? People were not, you know, typically did not feel comfortable airing negative things, you know, including in our community. And so it was hard to get going. Once they got going, they really got into it. people particularly didn't like the vegetarian food. That was the main complaint, right? But, you know, they didn't, you know, it was hard to get into. But once they got into it, it's like something opened up and everyone just was really enthusiastic about saying both positive and negative things. So it's, there are cultural aspects, you know, there are cultural aspects to this as well. So there's that kind of, conditioning, you know, and yeah, so we have that conditioning. I remember hearing a man named John Gottman, who does work with couples. He's written some of the leading books on couples therapy. And he says that he can, by looking at whether people are conflict avoidant or conflict indulgent, talk with them for 3 minutes and have a 94% accuracy in whether they'll be together in 3 years. Because basically, if they have the same conflict style, it's much better chance they'll be together. It's not that one of them is better, but the, you know, two conflict-avoidant people will be together. Two conflict-indulgent people will be together. Interesting, right? Okay, I'll just mention a few other factors that make conflict difficult. We have strong tendencies in the culture to be dualistic when it comes to conflicts. Look for winners or losers. You know, we don't have a sense of trying to find solutions which work for everyone, or that's not so common. We also, and actually the things I'll mention here, the problems all point to these five practices, which I'll name. Okay? So another problem is that when we have conflicts, we get into difficult emotions that are hard to be with. Another is that we get reactive. We're not very conscious. We just we say things without awareness. We get into difficult emotions and so forth. We also get attached to views and so forth. We lack empathy. And so I want to name now, I think I have here, let's see. Actually, I have six practices. So this will be the heart of my talk and what I'll be inviting people to work with in the next week. So six ways to practice with differences or conflicts. The first is to be willing to go into the territory of conflict, to be willing to explore difference and conflict. So this can sometimes require a strong intention, especially if we have that conditioning to not be comfortable with conflict. You know, I know, even though I personally have worked with this for many, many years, my original conditioning still has some strength, right? And I can notice if there's a conflict, part of me says, I don't like this. Let's ignore it or whatever. And so, but then I can remember my intention to go into it. So the first practice is to be willing to explore conflict, to explore differences, even if it, you know, and I should say at the beginning that it can sometimes be helpful to clarify the language, that most of us, when we hear the word conflict, we think of hostility or aggression, right? How many people hear the word conflict and hear hostility or aggression in the term? We have to redefine conflict as meaning simply the presence of a difference. You know, the presence of a difference. So I could have a conflict about what to paint my kitchen. I could have a conflict with my partner. What color should we paint my kitchen? That's a difference. And so it doesn't necessarily involve hostility or aggression, not necessarily a problem. So I'd like to redefine conflict in that way as simply a difference. So can I open up to differences? And can I go into that area? That's the first practice. And if we're doing that with a friend, it can often be helpful to have the friend agree to work with, or a friend or in a community to agree to go into the territory. Second really fundamental practice is empathy. It's the ability to actually listen to another or to someone else's views with whom we have differences, and to want to know what the other person's view is without simply trying to defeat it from the beginning. Empathy is crucial. You know, and it, you know, there was a columnist in the San Francisco Chronicle who wrote in 2016 during the election. He said, "I argue that the lack of empathy is the most pressing issue in America, and it's more compelling than national security threats, bad trade deals, unpaid taxes, and deleted emails." That, if you remember the 2000 campaign. And so this was really talking about empathy. A lot of people who work with the issue of polarization emphasize the crucial nature of empathy. Just a few words about it. It's something I like to teach about often. Empathy is the tuning in to another's experience. And I'll teach about two fundamental ways we do that. They're actually, the science shows that there are three kinds of empathy, and that empathy is actually a natural capacity that all of us have, although it can be suppressed. It can be covered over. Empathy, from a scientific point of view, involves three parts of the brain. We can be empathic towards someone's emotions. That's the usual sense of empathy. I can know what the other person is experiencing emotionally. I can also know, a second aspect is more cognitive. I can know what's meaningful for the person. You know, I can know, you know, when the other person is speaking about some aspect, let's say, of work. I can know, oh, it's really important for you to be doing this kind of work, right? And I can, you know, I can hear also the emotion of maybe of joy. And then the third is more at the bodily level, which I won't focus so much on, but there is a way that in our brains, when we see someone walking across the street, our brains have an image of that person walking. This is what are called the mirror neurons. And so the way I've developed a practice, along with my colleague Oren J. Sofer, we've developed an empathy practice based on the first two, in which we try to understand another by tuning in, number one, what are the emotions? Maybe just be one. And then secondly, what's meaningful for the person? What matters for the person? So this is a practice we can do. And one way I like to do this, Carlita, we can use those handouts. Some of you think I've used this in past talks, but I like to use material from the nonviolent communication to identify a variety of emotions. You know, this is something, you know, maybe I can, we can make this available to everyone. This is a chart of different emotions. There's a whole page on this, and this is probably more familiar to us, but it helps us have a little more emotional literacy where we can really say, oh, you're feeling, you know, you're feeling this. Let's go over some of them again. So there are all these variants of being loving. You know, I can be warm, affectionate. I can feel grateful, trusting. I can be, you know, happy, excited, joyful, and so forth. There's also, for the second aspect of empathy, we'll go to another handout, which is on what are called needs in nonviolent communication. These are really what matters, and they are, let's show that now, and that is, let's go down just so we have autonomy at the top. Is there a way that we can have this a little smaller so more shows on the screen? Yeah, there you go. Great. So we can see that there a number of different needs, and these are taken to be distinguished from strategies. So a need, so for example, I can have a need for peace. And my strategy can be that of drinking. I can actually become an alcoholic. My need is for peace, and that need is genuine. And so what's characteristic of these needs, or what I would call what matters, is that they're all genuine and valid. And even if someone has an unskillful strategy, there's always a genuine need there. That's very significant for differences and conflicts, because we could have a difference with someone, and the difference might be about the strategy, not the need. Actually, when I work with people, I often find that two people have a conflict. They differ about the strategy. You know, so for example, I may be a meeting leader, and I may be chairing a meeting. My need is for, let's say, efficiency in the meeting. You know, getting the objectives complete. My strategy might be to be what we call a control freak, to really cut people off, try to control the meeting in a way which doesn't feel comfortable for others. But my need is for efficiency, and that has validity. So we can let go of this now. So one of the things which is really helpful in a conflict is tuning in that way. You know, can I see the need of someone? Because we'll often find people we disagree with nonetheless have genuine needs. So I remember I once was part of a retreat that took place at Los Alamos National Laboratory. We were in a way protesting nuclear weapons, you know, and the development of them. But we took our lunches every day in the cafeteria, and we met with scientists and technicians. And I tried to be empathic and hear what was there. And, you know, we didn't have an agenda. We just would have lunch with people. They very often would try to justify why it's important to build nuclear weapons, and they would use values like security. Well, security is a valid need, right? You could argue about the strategy, but if you're going to be empathic, you want to recognize what the need is, right? And so, you know, a way to do that practice is to be with another person. And I think I've had us practice this together, is to be with another person and tune in the moment to what's what the emotions are and what the underlying needs are. So I'm gonna do that right now with you all. I want you to be empathic towards Donald. Anyone willing to be empathic towards Donald in a little practice? Okay, very good. Be empathic towards me. I'm going to talk for about 2 minutes, and I'm going to talk about just something very everyday, and I want you to be empathic, tune in to my emotions, and just come up with 2 or 3 of them, and then tune in to what matters for me. Okay, ready? I'm going to start. Set your intention to be empathic. Okay. In the last 2 months, where I live in Berkeley, California, the swimming pools have been closed for repair. Swimming is my main form of exercise, so I wasn't sure what would happen. I was concerned. And luckily, I found that there were some other local pools I could join, and I've been going to one that's a little further away, but it's open and it's a beautiful pool, and I've got to meet some new people. And it's outside, and it's even a bigger pool, and I might even keep on going there. I don't know. And so it's worked out okay, and it's been great to meet people. Okay, cut. Okay, what were some of my emotions that you heard? You can just raise your hand. Okay, maybe just speak, unmute and speak up, yeah.
I just excited.
Concern and delighted.
Concern, delighted, yep.
Excited.
Worried.
Pride.
What, pride?
Surprise.
Surprise, yeah.
Gratitude.
Gratitude, yeah. So the empathy is very ordinary, right? Everyone was 100% accurate with me. You know, it's an innate capacity. You're doing great with your empathy practice. Continue it for the next week. How about what matters for me? And maybe just have a like one sentence or one word.
Being health. Able to good health.
Good health, okay. Yeah.
With collectivity.
Collectivity?
Physical activity.
Activity, yeah.
Continuing swimming.
Continuing swimming. And let's connect that with a more universal need. We might say that's my strategy. It could be connected with health. What else?
How about public pools, Donald? Don't you care about that?
Yeah, I think I didn't mention it, but I value having what? Meeting needs publicly, something like that. Yeah.
And the needs also of being... Yeah.
Say again.
Joy.
Yeah, joy.
Yeah, to feel good, well-being.
That joy was, joy was an emotion, and could also edge into the needs. Yeah, please. Was Karen?
Friendship and fellowship.
Friendship and fellowship, right. So again, 100% accurate, you're all tremendously empathic, keep it going. So you get an idea, very simple practice. And you can do it at a distance. You can even, listen to the news. You hear an interview with someone, be empathic. Just see, okay, you write it down. What are the emotions? Because we need to practice this a lot. It's easy, and just keep practicing. What are the emotions? What matters? You can look at, I wish I could, if there was an easy way. Is there an easy way to get those handouts, Carlita? I'd have to give probably a link or something, right?
I did put the attachments in the chat. If anyone has difficulty opening those, send me a chat of your email, and I'd be happy to send it to you that way as well.
Oh, fantastic, because those are very, very useful. You may be able to just go to Nonviolent Communication website and find the equivalent, of, maybe not the exact list. So empathy is a second core practice, really fundamental. And I would connect it. I was thinking of, my colleague Kazu Haga wrote a book on nonviolence as practice. And he said that, the nonviolence of Gandhi and King is rooted in valuing relationship. So empathy is really, really crucial. And if you look to the writings of Dr. King, you'll find continual empathy for his opponents. Pretty remarkable, right? He often said that the civil rights movement was for the bodies of black people and the souls of white people. Because, the whole thing of white supremacy, he said, was destructive for the souls of people who thought themselves white, right? So there was empathy there. It wasn't saying you were bad people, I don't want to talk to you. There was empathy. And it's very hard in conflictual situations to have that empathy. So that's a practice. Third practice is working with our attachment to views. Anyone here attached to views at all? Okay. And so part of the practice is, you could probably do this right now, name your top five views that you're attached to. And again, here we're not asking ourselves to give up our views, but can we give up being rigidly attached to views? And how do we know that we're rigidly attached? Well, probably our friends will tell us very quickly, right? But make your list of your top five views you're attached to, whether it's a political view, a personal view, really a view could be a view about anything. For the Buddha, working with views was central to traditional practice. There's one line where he said, this is from 2,600 years ago. And think about this in terms of polarization. Anger, confusion, and dishonesty arise when things are set in pairs as opposites. When there's that polarization, And the Buddha also said that actually views are at best helpful and skillful, and that we shouldn't think that they convey absolute truth. At best, they're useful. And at worst, they're not useful. Yeah. And even harmful. And so we want to see, where am I attached to views? If you notice yourself having a strong view, bring mindfulness to it. What's it like? What's happening? What's going on when I'm in the midst of this view? You know, what's my experience? What's connected with it? Is there anger connected with it or sadness? You know, am I actually open to other people's views? Look into that. Do I want other people to all have my view? Anyone relate to that? Be honest. Okay. I think I should see almost everyone's hands up when I ask that. Okay. And am I really interested in hearing others' perspective? Am I open to changing my view? Really questions to ask yourself, right? And And again, you know, personally, I've often been interested in having discussions where we could actually talk across different views. I was once a college teacher at a place called Kenyon College in Ohio, and I was in the philosophy department, and large numbers of people from the political science department had come from the University of Chicago, connected with the neoconservative movement. They had very different views than I did, but we were able to talk together, right? They had very, very different views, and I really look forward to talking with them because they were actually open. It was actually very interesting to talk with people who were open to talking with someone with different views. Doesn't happen very much, does it? Right? And so, can I engage in that? Then the fourth practice, again, the first practice is being willing to go into conflicts. Second is empathy. The third is working with our views. The fourth is working with our own reactivity, difficult emotions that come up when there are different views. So can I bring mindfulness if I get really angry or sad or have some other difficult emotions come up? Bring mindfulness to them. Be with the difficult emotions. Be with the reactivity. If I'm really, finding myself in my meditation or just in flow of daily life, really condemning someone else. Oh, that person is so stupid. Being very judgmental, maybe. Oh, why does that person have that? And we feel the reactivity and the energy. We want to explore that. Bring it to mindfulness in the moment when it's there. We can also, in our meditation, deliberately bring up moments of reactivity that were maybe happened earlier in the day or yesterday. When you're pretty settled, bring them up, try to be with them mindfully. And again, it's important to then have the guideline, which those of you who've worked with me for a while have heard many times, the guideline that know the level of intensity of your emotions, of your reactivity, and know whether it's in the workable range. I use that scale of 1 to 10. When it's a 9 or a 10 and it's too much, then what we want to do is come back to balance. Take a walk, talk to a friend, do some other meditation. Don't try to go into it when it's too much. But when it's in the workable range, explore it. And you can use practices like naming what's happening, being willing to be with it, exploring what's it like in the body, what's it like in the mind, what's it like in terms of the emotions. Really explore that way. A fifth practice is wise speech. Developing skillful speech. And this is probably, I'll just be brief here. Maybe I'll talk more about this next time. When we have differences and conflicts, it's very helpful to work with the guidelines of wise speech, including the traditional ones, which come from 2,600 years ago. And so the four guidelines, which you've probably heard from me at times, for wise speech are being truthful. All of these have to be together at once. Being truthful, being helpful, coming from a kind heart, even if we're saying, I don't agree with that or no. And then fourthly, having good timing. And with differences and conflicts, good timing is crucial. We can be truthful, really sensitive, and have bad timing and make a total mess. So timing, interesting, the Buddha was walking around 2,600 years ago saying, check out your timing. How's your timing? Make sure you have good timing. And that's I like that. That's actually, you know, he was apparently doing that. And so, you know, can I say what's truthful to me without being reactive and demonizing the other? So again, I think I'll talk more about that next time. And the last one, I want to end with this, is to bring in the kind heart. Can I bring in the kind heart with differences and conflicts? Maybe through loving kindness practice. What I have found when there are differences or conflicts interpersonally, often compassion can be most useful. Just having a sense, oh, this is painful for me, this is painful for the other person. When we go there, just in a very simple way, something soft can soften in the heart. And we maybe are more, less, you know, stuck in my views. So there, you know, the very simple compassion practice is that is from Kristen Neff is number one, acknowledge this is hard for me, maybe for the other. Secondly, know that this is something that happens to all human beings, number two. Number three, offer some kind words to myself or to the other. That's a two-minute self-compassion practice we can do. Okay, so bringing in the heart practice, whether it's loving kindness or forgiveness, maybe again, I think I'll come to these more. So here's, I want to end with a poem. And after I read the poem, Carlita will put the link for the poem in the chat. So if you want to hear it, this is a poem called Because, and it relates to our theme of polarization in the world and coming from a kind heart. It's by Rosemary Traumer. It was just written a few weeks ago. A friend let me know about it just a little while ago. Okay, this is called Because, and I'll end with this. So I can't save the world. Can't save even myself. Can't wrap my arms around every frightened child. Can't foster peace among nations. Can't bring love to all who feel unlovable. So I practice opening my heart, right here in this room, and being gentle with my insufficiency. I practice walking down the street heart first. And if it is insufficient to share love, I will practice loving anyway. I want to converse about truth, about trust. I want to invite compassion into every interaction. One willing heart can't stop a war. One willing heart can't feed all the hungry. And sometimes, daunted by a task too big, I tell myself, what's the use of trying? But today the invitation is clear, to be ridiculously courageous in love, to open the heart like a lilac in May, knowing freeze is possible and opening anyway, to take love seriously, to give love wildly, to race up to the world as if I were a puppy, adoring and unjaded, stumbling on my own exuberance, to feel the shock of indifference, of anger, of cruelty, of fear, and stay open, to love as if it matters, as if the world depends on it. So I'll stop there. And let's just have a moment or two for silent reflection, or just letting yourself be present with what's there. And see if there's anything you want to share or ask about. maybe a short story about learning from difference, learning from conflict. Good, we'll start with Nancy, and you can either, after Nancy, you can do go to the raised hand function. That's the easiest. And I can also, if you have your video on, I can also see you. So, Nancy, please.
So, Donald, as you were talking, I was reflecting on my life. And I was raised in a household where rage was the order of the day.
Well,
yelling, slamming doors. And I replicated that in my first marriage. When I got out of that marriage, I was a single parent, and I emerged in conflict avoidant. And I was conflict avoidant with my daughter, as is she. In my second marriage, I was able to find what I would call the middle path. Neither rage nor avoiding conflict. We would yell sometimes, but we would sit down and talk and clear things out, clear things up, and it was amazing. Wow. It was the first time that I had, but there was a 25-year span. Took a lot of meditation retreats and a lot of inner work to get there.
Oh, beautiful.
Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Nancy, for sharing that. And so you actually experienced both of the main forms of conflict conditioning, both what I was calling indulgence and then avoidance, right?
Yes. And then, but Donald, one other thing. So I have a more conservative son-in-law and nephew. And when I'm with them, I get into my point of view is right. I want to convince you. And I find it difficult. And I will have to, as you were talking, I was thinking of a way I could just ask a question of my son-in-law rather than either just avoid the conversation or be, you know, our views so pressed against each other. So thank you for that. I came up with an idea as you were talking. I think I would find it, I still find it very difficult. I still think my views are right. And I wondered as you were speaking, how do you have empathy for a Hitler? How do you have empathy? I'm sorry if there are any of you who like Donald Trump, but how do you do that?
Yeah. Thanks, Nancy. And I would say that do the empathy practice, with the person in your family. Try to sincerely understand where the view is coming from. You know, and understand what it is, and asking questions is great, right? And yeah, and in terms of the question about empathy for Hitler, for an extreme, first of all, we want to recognize as we teach with loving kindness practice, the horizon that the Buddha gives for loving kindness is loving kindness for all beings, which includes the people who've done the worst things. But we work up to it not by starting at all with even the moderately difficult. We work up to the extremes. So that's one piece. But we can know that it's possible. You know, maybe possible even to be with people who maybe 10 years ago you couldn't have empathy for. That being said, actually, we can find in the lives of even someone like Hitler, if you look at their childhood, you find the roots of everything, and you find basically trauma and pain. You know, so the basic understanding is that at our depths, our hearts are kind and good, right? But But we can see that there's some, so I think we deepen in this as we really deepen in our own practice and we come more and more to see the most basic level of our being as, the teacher Ram Dass called loving awareness. I think I'm seeing some people contributing on the chats to that one. That's a hard one, But I would, you know, I have read biographies of Hitler, for example, and I know, you know, you can find so much in the childhood, you know, and then, you know, as well as, you know, later. Anyway, I won't go so much into that, but those would be the two responses. First of all, focus on where it's workable. Yeah. What were some, Carlita, what were some of those responses in the chat around that issue?
Yeah, I'd be happy to read that.
I think Charles had one. Yeah.
Having empathy doesn't mean approval.
That's right. That's right. That's crucial.
There's an old saying there, but by the grace of God, go I. And then also, wouldn't we have loving kindness for those beings, but not for their actions necessarily?
That's right. Yeah, distinguish between the person and the action. Yeah, that kind of reminds me. That's what my mom taught that. I mean, there's a story that I think I've told once or twice from my, my brother was doing something that my mom didn't like. He was 5 years old. And she said, I really love you, but what you were doing, let's talk about it. And, his answer was, don't talk to me like a psychologist. Why don't you just spank me like the parents down the street? Right. So that distinction between the being and the action, really, really crucial. And that, and then I think some of you know the poem by Thich Nhat Hanh called Please Call Me By My True Names. If you don't know it, you can look it up. That's also an answer to that question. You know, where Thich Nhat Hanh is basically empathic towards a sea pirate who has, killed and done horrible things to people. That's in that poem, Please Call Me By My True Name. Yeah. Other sharing, questions, reflections? That's a big one to actually, it looks like Stella, please. It's a big one to actually, make that distinction between one can be empathic without approving of the action. Very crucial. Stella, please. You're still muted, Stella.
Okay. Okay, thanks. I'm actually going back a bit because I when you were talking about views, I started writing down a couple of my views, but they didn't fit in at all to what you were talking about. And then I realized that what you call views, which I don't know, still don't really know the definition of, but what I wrote down were values, which are my views, so to speak.
Yeah.
So so then I got kind of lost because, for instance, the first view I wrote down was nonviolence and my commitment to nonviolence.
Yeah.
And then when you start talking about the different views, so I guess maybe now at this point in the presentation and the discussion, I guess what I'm thinking of is that maybe when we see that there are difference in views, maybe a good way to go forward is to look for the values in the views, and often we'll uncover similar values. Nonviolence is not a value that's widely shared in the United States of America, but other values are. And so I think what we're looking for is a place where we can find agreement and commonality, and from there, when there is conflict, and go out from there, where we go, well, since we both hold the value of kindness, let's say, let's proceed forward from that value. Yeah. I don't know what you think of that, but yeah, I was trying to figure it out.
Yeah, no, thanks, Del. That's helpful. It really brings out, helps us to bring out more clearly what I was meaning by views, because I didn't give a definition. I think you're accurate that I brought in the framework of nonviolent communication, the distinction between needs or what matters, and on the one hand, and strategies on the other. And the I think our what I was calling views are going to be connected with our values. You know, the views are going to be connected. If you have a, you know, but it might be more. It's probably not a very always clear distinction between needs, which really connects a lot with values. Values could be a synonym for needs in the sense of non-like communication. And the views might, so you might have a need, you know, like you say, for peace or for love or for kindness. And, you know, and, you know, nonviolence might be in some way a strategy. So some of the views might be more like strategies, right? Mm-hmm. So, but I think it's, there's not a, you know, clear and fine distinction between them. But I think you're right to say to go to what is more, you know, what's more universal, you know, love or kindness or peace, and see where one's views, you know, might, you know, nonviolence in some way could be juxtaposed to those who think violence is okay sometimes, right? And so that yeah. those would be different
that's
views.
True.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, great. That's true. And yeah.
Great.
I wanted to just add on to that. We were talking about the problem.
Stella, could you be brief? Because I.
Oh, yeah, okay. I just want
to say
that.
I have one more person I wanted to get to. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I just want to say that in the nonprofit that I worked in, I thought it was really important to say that process is always on the table.
Yeah.
Even if it hasn't been, flagged. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. The attention to process in organization and groups is so crucial. I think I saw Sylvia. Did you have one question or a comment?
I just have a comment. So I think sometimes our views are so strong that we don't want to know what the other side is.
Right.
It's so. For example, I was watching this documentary called "College Behind Prisons."
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, have this college program that's like based in New York for maximum security prisoners. And so I was able to watch through, but my husband, who is like, they did something wrong, they kill people, they harm people, like they don't deserve it at all. So he can't watch it through even the first episode. And because his screws are so strong that it just, yeah, I think it's kind of blocked us from having empathy because our views are so strong and put like a blinder.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really crucial point that is the case. If our views are so strong, we can't hear, you know, an idea, we can't hear another person. And so the practice that I'm encouraging for the next week is to see those kind of situations, you know, or see what situations make it hard for me to have empathy, or maybe notice when others have a hard time bringing empathy to a situation. And we want to focus a lot in developing empathy on very simple, ordinary situations, a little bit like the example we did with me. You know, I'm just talking about looking for a swimming pool, right? Very simple. And you can have empathy. Empathy doesn't have to just be there when there's a problem or a conflict. You can have empathy just in hearing a child or hearing someone talk. And I think it's valuable sometimes to really just say, okay, for the next 10 minutes, I want to just develop empathy without even worrying about the views. That could be interesting. Can do that as an experiment. Yeah. Okay, I think, well, I could go on for another half hour or hour. And it's a live discussion. How many people would like to work with these practices to work with differences and conflicts in the next week? And how many are open to that? Great. Okay. So let me. I'll have the recording up later today, and I'll just name those. I think I had six practices. I'll just name these again. They were, first of all, to have the intention to open up to differences, you know, to go into a territory where there are differences or even conflicts, being willing to do that, number one. Number two, the practice of empathy. Okay, Number three, looking at your views, looking at where we really have strong views. Again, we're not needing to get rid of views, but just to see when we have strong views, make a, you know, study what it's like when strong views are present, kind of very much like Sylvia was saying. Number four, work with times when the mind is reactive, difficult emotions are there, anger, irritation, something like that. Bring mindfulness to times when you're reactive, maybe being judgmental, blaming, so on. You know, study that with your mindfulness. Number five, work with wise speech when there are differences. You know, I gave the four guidelines, being truthful, helpful, coming from a good heart, and good timing. And the last one was bring in different ways, the kind heart, whether through compassion or loving kindness or could be even forgiveness. I think empathy often has a sense of the kind heart. So let's sit with those for a moment and set your intention for the next week. And then I'll close with dedication of merit. May our practice together and our exploration of working with differences or conflicts, difficult relationships, whether it's in the family or community or larger world, may our practice be beneficial to us, be beneficial to those close to us, and may it ultimately be beneficial. May our morning, our time together, our evening be beneficial to all beings, which includes us. So thanks, everyone. Thanks for your kind listening. Thanks, Carlita. Yay, Carlita. Hey, thanks everyone, and yeah, take notes during the week and come back and we can share what we've explored. I'm not wishing for you to have more conflicts than usual, but if they do occur, take advantage. Okay, thanks everyone.
Thank you,
if you want to unmute, you can say goodbye.
Bye everybody, thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thanks. A pleasure.
Another question.
Great talk.
Okay. Okay, till next time. Okay, thanks again, Carlita.
Thank you so much, Dom. Look forward to seeing you next week.
Okay. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thanks, Sangha. See you next week. Bye-bye.